This is the Education Gadfly Show.
I wish that I was going someplace as awesome as Amber.
Is this an always a bridesmaid, never a bride sort of moment for you, Darren?
No.
Okay, Michelle's cringing.
Now, here's your host, Mike Petrilli.
Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute here at the Education Gadfly Show and online at edexcellence.net. And now, please join me in welcoming my co-host, the John McCain of Education Policy, Michelle Gininger.
I do not have a poker app on my phone, for the record.
I didn't even get that reference, Michelle. But
whoa, where are you?
I don't know. I was referring to the fact that, you know, the Syria debate, he's like such a happy warrior. He's the only person, it seems like, in the country who's actually excited about going and starting another war in the Middle East.
Well, he was caught playing poker on his iPhone during the hearing yesterday.
Really?
I mean,
ooh, I didn't hear that one.
Yes.
I was not even making a reference about your use of the iPhone. Though, do you sometimes, you know, by chance, multitask?
I always multitask with all of my work projects.
Uh-huh.
But no gambling for me.
Yes. No playing poker. Do we think he was actually, was he putting real money on
no, stuff? I don't think it was you know, the 3-hour hearing that was clearly very interesting to him.
Yeah, I guess that's kind of sad. Oh, I don't know. Should we start another war? Let me just play poker
if we win this round.
Well, at least he was there at the hearing. Hey, big days, of course, on this big talk in Syria. A lot of tough issues. You know, I can't help but notice some of the similarities here with some of the other debates in education, like the Common Core. You know, you have this dynamic where you've got some big portion of the Republican Party that just doesn't want to go to war with Syria because they hate President Obama and think this is somehow doing him a favor. It feels a little bit familiar with some of those similar arguments on the Common Core. You know, if President Obama wasn't so in favor of it, maybe it wouldn't be so bad.
We just have a very divided Republican Party, and it's a problem when you're opposed to something because the president supports it, or you support something because the president supports it.
And of course, the Democrats are quite divided on this and on education as well. All right, let's talk education policy. This is not the Foreign Affairs Gadfly Show. This is the Education Gadfly Show. Pamela, back from vacation in the Philippines, where they do have television, she says, and they did talk about Miley Cyrus, but we're not going to go there, Michelle. We covered that last week.
Oh, good.
All right, Pamela, let's get started with Pardon the Gadfly.
In an op-ed, the Washington Post decried the DOJ's petition to disallow Louisiana from awarding vouchers for the 2014-15 school year to students in public schools that are under federal desegregation orders, noting flatly that 9 of 10 Louisiana children who receive vouchers to attend private schools are Black. Where do you stand on this issue?
Well, where do we stand? I mean, you used to work at the School Choice Alliance. We support school choice. Look, this is ridiculous. What is the Department of Justice thinking?
And this is the second time that they've actually waded into these waters. Remember, a few months ago, they sent a letter to the Milwaukee private schools participating in the program about some of the special needs disabilities angle. I mean, this is federal overreach, whether you believe in strong federal government or not. I mean, this is just over the line.
No, it's way over the line. And here's the issue, okay? I mean, I understand that they feel a responsibility to uphold these desegregation orders, which are now 30, 40 years old, right? But we're talking about mostly African-American, low-income African-American parents
at failing schools.
At failing schools, freely choosing to move their children from one school to another, in most cases from schools that are overwhelmingly African-American, racially isolated schools to private schools, which are much less racially isolated, that are actually integrated. In other words, this voucher program is promoting the ends, the goal of integration. So it's like, what are we doing here? We're losing the forest for the trees. What are those lawyers doing?
It's also ridiculous in the fact that the 60s and 70s, this stuff was needed. I mean, there was a lot of shady and racist things happening, but now this is about helping low-income Black children, and we need to allow that to happen. We shouldn't use a law that's been on the books for a while just to fight a political fight.
Yeah, and you know, Arnie Duncan was asked this week on the Diane Rehm show what he thought of this case, and he said that he was not familiar with it. I guess the secretary has not been reading the clips that I know are sent to him him every day.
But I will say this. This is a great move for the movement with the Washington Post. I mean, they've always been supportive of the D.C. Opportunity Scholarship Program, but that was a very small program in their backyard. Now they're, I say bravo to them for calling the president out on this, calling the entire administration out on this, and going for an issue that mm-hmm. many on the left have been uncomfortable with for some
time. This has given Bobby Jindal a very good issue to play up, and he's doing it. Okay, topic number two.
Last week, Allison Benedict wrote for Slate Magazine, "If you send your child to a private school, you are a bad person." What's her point?
Are you a bad person, Michelle?
I would send my non-existent kids to a good school.
No matter where.
No matter where.
Private school, too.
Private, public, charter, doesn't matter.
Mm-hmm. There you go. Look, this article, in one way, let's admit that it was brilliant. I mean, the title was brilliant. The first paragraph was brilliant. It's got a gazillion comments. All of us had felt the need to respond. I wrote a somewhat satirical response for National Review Online that said, if you send your kid to a failing school, you are a bad person. As I said, that doesn't include parents who have no choice but to send their kids to failing schools. But others, the more that we have parents sending their kids to the best school possible, the more likely all schools will improve. But Benedict's argument falls apart on so many different degrees. One is which, of course, she's talking about making it sound like all public schools are these common schools where kids come together across lines of race and class. Ha! Right. Maybe in a few handful of areas in some cities and some inner ring suburbs. But the vast majority of public schools are actually quite segregated, as we just talked about. And you look in the, what does she make of suburban schools? What we've called at Fordham, private public schools. Public schools where the only way you get to send your kid there is if you buy a really expensive house close to the school.
We don't all get to live in Montgomery County.
Or grow up in Fairfax County?
Yes, I'm guilty of that as well. I mean, the reality is I don't buy the sacrifice your kid for the greater good. It's all about, I agree with you, and I think your NRO piece was great. It's about, if we all have the highest standards for our own kids, then the system in itself will improve.
Michelle, no, this is a problem with us doing the show together. I know you're our flack here, okay? But you're supposed to disagree with me sometimes. You can't just say that what I wrote was great, even though I have to say, Pamela, it was pretty good. But truth be told here, I mean, it was the easiest blog post I ever wrote because I don't know, 80% of the words, 90% were Alice and Benedict's. I only had to change a few.
Should we change to what we disagree on? Because I have a list.
Yes, absolutely. Let's go for it.
Let's go for it. I don't hate obese teachers, for one thing.
Yeah, well, yeah. See, that is a place where we disagree. Look, I don't hate them. I have sympathy for them. I hate the sin, not the sinner, Michelle. I just don't know that having obese, and I don't mean just a little bit overweight. I mean, obese teachers sitting in front, probably sitting, let's be frank, probably not standing, sitting in front of a classroom of kids is all that great. It's a bad role model. All right, topic number three.
Yes. Mike, yesterday on the Diane Rehm Show, a listener called in to comment that schools ought to bring back art and humanities to elementary curricula. What was your E.D. Hirsch-inspired response?
Oh, thanks for the easy softball question. Well, what I was arguing and what Don Hirsch has argued in the past is that Common Core provides this great opportunity to bring back history, geography, civics, art, music to the elementary school curriculum, which currently is a vast wasteland, okay? Partly because of No Child Left Behind and the idea that people seem to have that, okay, if we're going to boost reading scores, we're going to just get rid of everything else and just focus on, quote, reading. But as Hirsch shows and argues, the only way you improve reading once kids learn how to decode is for them to learn content knowledge, for them to learn, build their vocabulary. And you do that by teaching history and civics and all the rest. But Michelle, is that message getting out to schools? I don't see any evidence of it.
Well, it's certainly getting out to New York schools. I was at an event this week with the Center for American Progress where New York Commissioner King was there speaking, and he was a cheerleader for Core Knowledge and E.D. Hirsch, and it was refreshing to hear. Not to say that there were a lot of skeptical questions from the audience, but here is a huge school system that is creating free Common Core aligned curriculum that is based on E.D. Hirsch. And I think that is a huge step forward. And if New York succeeds at this, I think we can really get a momentum going to make sure that E.D. Hirsch's thoughts are getting into our teachers' classrooms, and therefore kids are learning to read and learning about dinosaurs.
I mean, exactly, learning about dinosaurs. I mean, look, this is, I think, the best selling point for the Common Core is that they bring back content. Content is back, baby. It's back. But that message, I don't know. Maybe it's getting through New York. I hope it gets through in other places, not just because it's a good selling point for the Common Core, but because it's good for kids. And it's a great antidote to what has happened under the No Child Left Behind era. We need this content back in our schools. You know, one positive thing I will say, if we're gonna be glasses half full, is that now even Sesame Street is trying to do a better job teaching content. So maybe Hirsch's ideas are getting out there.
Will that make your Netflix list?
It may. I don't know about my Netflix list, but we'll find a way to show some love for Big Bird.
Let's make t-shirts.
T-shirts. I like that. You know, by the way, Sesame Street, maybe this is just a ploy for them to get their federal funding back up, which would not be a bad play. Okay, that's all the time we've got for this week. Now it's time for everyone's favorite, Amber's Research Minute. Amber, wait, there's no Amber. I can't welcome Amber back to the show. Amber is on her way to her wedding. So welcome to the show, Dara Z. Handler.
Thank you. I wish that I was going someplace as awesome as Amber.
Uh-huh. Is this an always a bridesmaid, never a bride sort of moment for you, Dara?
No.
Okay. Michelle's cringing. I should not have gone there, should I?
I think she was referring to the vacation time and the location.
Okay. Oh, man. And even our producer, Joe, is just shaking his head at me. All right.
Well, really, the whole room is cringing.
I have stepped in that one. All right. Dara, you take all the time you want for your research minute.
Thank you. Today we've got a report from the Manhattan Institute, which is also out today, called Reforming Teacher Compensation. The authors, Marcus Winters and Josh McGee, put some hard numbers behind two what-if pension reform scenarios. These are two of many actions proposed by reformers, us included, on how to change teacher retirement plans so that they are financially sustainable, fair to new teachers, and appealing to all teachers. And what's important is the report examines two cost-neutral reforms, meaning zero net long-term costs. And it asked what would happen to teacher compensation in the nation's 10 largest districts under these two reforms. So first, the way that traditional pension plans are set up, new teachers gain small benefits at the start of their careers and only accrue large benefits at the end. But the authors asked, what would happen if districts used a schedule of smooth accrual so that retirement wealth is more evenly accumulated over a teacher's career? And second, they look at compensation distribution compared to the private sector. A relatively high percentage of teachers' total compensation is actually deferred, but the authors asked what would happen if a high percentage of compensation went towards salary instead. So they used information from district and state pension plans for the nation's 10 largest districts and modeled how those two conditions would actually affect compensation. Here's what they found. Smooth accrual would lead to substantially higher total compensation early in a teacher's career, with only small or moderate losses later. This is important because most teachers don't stay to their full retirement age. So it gives teachers who stay 15 or 20 years a much more secure path to retirement. Not only that, but some districts could significantly raise teacher salaries across the board with these reforms, which would be appealing to both new and veteran teachers. Bottom line is that they found these two reforms would allow districts to offer more attractive compensation packages to prospective new teachers without significantly affecting the benefits of veterans, and all without raising costs to the taxpayers or cutting money from other programs.
Well said, but it sounds too good to be true, Dara. So let's take this in context. We've been doing a lot of work on pension programs, and what we show is that many of the costs of these pension programs are about to explode, and that in effect, what states are finding if they want to shore up their pensions is they've got to bilk the new teachers. They've got to have the new teachers paying into the old system, or else the Ponzi scheme is going to collapse. So what do you do about, you know, these outstanding debts that the pension systems already have?
Well, unfortunately, this sounds like a cop-out answer, but we're talking about two different issues. These two proposed reforms are current pension sustainability issues. So taking this as a baseline, how do you move forward from here and actually create a sustainable pension system that is fiscally responsible, attractive to new teachers, and amenable to the veterans so that they will negotiate these into their collective bargaining agreements? It unfortunately does not address the elephant in the room in some states, which is the existing pension unfunded liabilities. And for those, those costs
those debts exist already. So the only way to deal with those is to raise more money. You got to put money into the system somehow. So these reforms do not address the unfunded liability, but they do create a sustainable system moving forward.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think this is a real conundrum for reformers. You know, I certainly like this report a lot. And I think that all of us would say, look, we want to make teaching an attractive profession, especially earlier in the career. I mean, we see that, look, starting salaries aren't bad, but it's after 5 years or so when, you know, most other careers, people's salaries have increased quite dramatically as they have on-the-job experience, and teacher salaries have only gone up a smidgen, and then teachers leave. It's very rational. So can we increase those sort of 5 to 10 to 15-year salaries much faster? And you know, people, younger people don't care as much about their retirement benefits. But the problem is, what do we do about this elephant, about these unfunded liabilities? You know, should we embrace a policy that says, you know, that states or even the federal government should offer a bailout, you know, to just start fresh, bail out these state systems? Is that a better move than asking new teachers to pay the costs of those of the past generation's bad decisions? I mean, this is a really tough, I feel like it's really going to pit the sort of fiscal conservatives, perhaps against reformers who are concerned primarily about teacher quality.
Well, and I hate to say it, but there's something to be said for saying that this is not a problem of the school system's making. So there's two primary ways that you can reduce the unfunded liability. One is take money away from the school districts in some way,
right,
whether that's cutting programs or increasing contributions or whatever, and using that to shore up the pensions. And the other one is raising taxes. You got to put the money in there somewhere. And I might argue that it's not necessarily a problem of the school system's making.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, if governors don't want to, they're going to need to raise additional revenue. If that happens by raising taxes, well, now they're paying for past poor decision making.
I have an idea.
Uh-oh.
Sell the buildings. Sell the buildings, okay? I mean, some states are selling their highways, right? Sell the buildings. You could raise a whole lot of money, use the money to pay off some of these pensions. And by the way, then have somebody in charge of the buildings who was neutral about which kinds of schools inhabit them, public schools or charter schools. That would be a much more fair system. Boom, solved, done.
I don't disagree, although it might work better for urban districts. Yeah. But
would we have advertising in these schools? I mean, could you have billboards down the hallway selling various products?
I hadn't thought about that, but I'll get back to you on those details. No, I don't know. I mean, just a random idea. But somehow, we're going to have to face this question head on. And which is our priority? Is it about making teaching an attractive profession, or is it the fiscal responsibility? Because you could say some states are being more responsible now because they are shoring up their pension systems, but they are doing it in a way that's putting it on the backs of new teachers, mostly making teaching even a less attractive profession, and conceivably giving them worse retirement benefits than they just have under Social Security alone.
I mean, that seems to be pushing another problem down the road. I mean, if you don't address your pension problem, you're going to get these huge unfunded liabilities. If you make new teachers suffer, you're going to have a teaching shortage down the road.
That's the conundrum. That is the conundrum. Okay, that is all the time we've got for this week. We will keep working on trying to solve that pension problem next week.
And keep working on increasing Mike Petrelli's tact.
Yes, I will increase the tact.
That's our next week. 5-year strategic plan.
Yes. But don't worry, I'll still be complaining about obese teachers because I feel strongly about that one. Okay, till next week.
I'm Michelle Gininger.
And I'm Mike Petrelli at the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, signing off.
The Education Gadfly Show is a production of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, located in Washington, D.C. For more information, visit us online at edexcellence.net.